All right, everyone, get ready, because today we are going deep on a case that really makes you think about DNA evidence and the Sixth Amendment, Williams v. Illinois.
Williams.
We all think of DNA evidence as, like, the gold standard, the thing that solves the case, right?
Right.
But this case shows how complicated things get when that evidence is presented in court.
What's fascinating about Williams is, you know, it really exposes how we have to balance things, like the need for good evidence and the defendant's right to confront their accuser. And the Supreme Court really struggled with it. You can tell from their split decision.
So to set the scene, we're in Chicago. Sandy Williams is on trial for a brutal attack, sexual assault, kidnapping, and robbery.
Right.
The victim, LJ, had a sexual assault examination at the hospital, and those swabs were sent to the Illinois State Police Crime Lab.
Yeah, and they confirmed there was semen present. So they decided to send a sample to an independent lab, Cellmark Diagnostics, for DNA analysis.
Okay.
And here's where it gets interesting. Cellmark creates a male DNA profile from the sample. That profile goes back to the Illinois State Police Lab, where forensic specialist Sandra Lambados compares it to Williams's DNA from a prior arrest. And it's a match.
So, case closed, right?
Well, not so fast.
What happened?
No one from Cellmark actually testified at Williams's trial.
Oh, wow.
It was only Lambados who testified, and she's the one talking about this DNA match.
That doesn't seem right.
Yeah, and that's what Williams' defense argued. They said this violates his Sixth Amendment right to confront his accuser.
I mean, it makes sense, right? Lambados didn't even do the analysis at Cellmark. So how could the defense even question her about it? Like, how reliable the procedures were, if there were any errors.
Exactly.
All that stuff.
All those crucial details.
It's like a game of scientific telephone, you know?
Uh-huh.
And to make things weirder, that actual Cellmark report wasn't even allowed as evidence.
Right. The lower court sided with the prosecution, though. They said Lambados wasn't talking about whether the Cellmark report was actually true, just using it to explain her opinion as an expert. But not everyone was buying that argument when the case went up to the Supreme Court.
Okay, so help me out here. What exactly is the Sixth Amendment? Give me a refresher on the Confrontation Clause.
Okay, so the Sixth Amendment is a really important principle that guarantees criminal defendants the right to confront the witnesses against them. That means they can be there when the witness is testified and they have the right to question them.
Okay.
So they can try to find holes in their statements and see if they're credible. The case that really laid out what kinds of statements trigger this right is Crawford v. Washington back in 2004.
Ah, Crawford.
Crawford established that the Confrontation Clause applies to testimonial statements, which are basically statements made to create evidence for a trial.
Okay.
But then things get messy because courts have had a lot of trouble figuring out what exactly testimonial means.
Yeah, it seems like there's been a lot of debate.
Oh, absolutely. We've got cases like Melendez-Diaz, which dealt with drug analysis reports, and Bullcoming about blood alcohol tests. In both those cases, the Supreme Court said lab reports are testimonial for sure, so the analysts have to testify. But Williams complicates things because, and this is important, the actual Cellmark report never even got into evidence.
So this is what makes Williams so confusing, right?
Right.
It's like, can an expert just repeat what's in a lab report without the actual analyst being questioned?
That's the million-dollar question.
Yeah.
And, well, the Supreme Court wasn't exactly united on the answer. The decision was 5-4, and there wasn't even a majority opinion, meaning there wasn't one legal argument that at least five justices agreed on.
Oh, wow.
It's what we call a fractured decision, which makes it super tricky for lower courts.
I can imagine.
So let's untangle these different opinions. The plurality opinion, what's that all about?
Yeah, let's dive into that.
All right. The plurality opinion, written by Justice Alito and joined by three other justices, focused on what they called the primary purpose of that Cellmark report. They were thinking Cellmark wasn't specifically trying to get Williams when they did their analysis.
Okay.
They were just trying to figure out who committed the crime.
But wait, isn't that a bit of a stretch? Like, once they had the DNA profile and Williams was a suspect, didn't the purpose of the report change? I mean, it feels pretty accusatory at that point.
That's the exact kind of question that makes this case so controversial. The plurality seemed to suggest that because the analysis happened before they even had a suspect, it couldn't be considered testimonial. But can we really draw such a hard line? It's a slippery slope.
So we've got this plurality opinion, but it's not, like, a majority of the court. What about the other justices?
Right. Well, Justice Thomas agreed that Williams's rights weren't violated, but for a completely different reason.
Okay. I'm intrigued. Tell me more.
He's a big originalist, right? Like, so his argument was that the Selmark report wasn't testimonial because it didn't look like an official legal document. Like, no affidavit, no sworn statement, none of that. Mm. He basically said, without those specific legal things, the confrontation clause doesn't even apply.
That's what worries me about this whole formality thing.
Yeah.
Like, what's to stop labs from just, I don't know, avoiding certain formalities just to get around the Sixth Amendment?
That's a big loophole for sure.
Sounds like a loophole.
And that's exactly what Justice Kagan was getting at in her dissent.
Oh, right, the dissent.
She was writing for the four dissenting justices. She called Lombardo's testimony a prosecutorial dodge because the truth of that Selmark report was really the heart of the prosecution's case.
So the dissent is saying that letting Lombardo's just summarize Selmark's findings without having the analyst actually there to be questioned is like a way for the prosecution to completely sidestep the confrontation clause.
Exactly. Think about it. If you were on trial and they didn't make you testify, but just let your friend take the stand and talk about stuff you said, that wouldn't be allowed, right?
Don't.
The dissent is saying the same principle should apply to scientific evidence. Mm. You can't just have someone repeat potentially damaging findings without giving the defense a chance to, you know, challenge where it came from.
This is all super interesting, but what about, like, the practical effects of this kind of split decision? Has it created chaos in the courts?
Well, it's definitely created a lot of uncertainty. Since the Williams decision, lower courts have really struggled with how to apply these different opinions.
I bet.
Some courts focus on the primary purpose test, trying to figure out the intent behind lab reports. Others use Justice Thomas's formality idea, which leads to really technical arguments about what is and isn't a testimonial statement.
It sounds like a total mess.
It kind of is, and this uncertainty has had some pretty serious consequences.
Oh, how so?
We've seen prosecutors be much more careful about how they present forensic evidence, often opting to have experts talk about the reasons for their opinions rather than risk having a key lab report thrown out on confrontation clause grounds.
But then that makes it harder for the defense to, like, actually challenge the science, right? If the report itself isn't allowed, they can't really look at the methods used, the potential for errors, all of that important stuff.
Exactly. And that's a problem because someone could be convicted based on scientific findings without a real chance to challenge the science behind it.
That doesn't seem fair at all.
Not really, no.
So we're in this weird spot where we want to protect defendants' rights, but we also don't want to, like, stop prosecutors from using legitimate scientific evidence.
It's a tough balancing act, for sure. And Williams really highlights how technology is changing the legal landscape.
It is.
DNA evidence is incredibly powerful, but it brings up new questions about fairness and due process in the courtroom.
I see what you mean. It really makes you think, do we need completely new rules for dealing with forensic evidence now that we have things like DNA analysis?
Okay.
I mean, the Sixth Amendment was written ages ago, long before anyone could even imagine DNA testing.
You're absolutely right. And Justice Breyer actually brought that up in his concurrence. He said the court should rethink these issues, suggesting that maybe we need a whole new framework to balance defendants' rights with the need for good scientific evidence.
So it sounds like Williams is a case with a lot of, you know, loose ends. It's going to keep having an impact as courts try to make sense of these different opinions, especially as technology keeps advancing so rapidly.
It definitely will. And it's important to remember the human element here, too. We're not just talking about abstract legal ideas, right? These concepts affect real people, defendants, victims, everyone involved in the pursuit of justice.
That's so important. It's not just a game. This is about making sure our system is fair and accurate, especially when we're using evidence as strong as DNA. So what if, just hypothetically, what if that Selmark report in Williams had specifically named Williams?
Interesting question.
Do you think the outcome would have been different?
That's a great question. If the report had actually pointed the finger at Williams, it would definitely have been more accusatory. It wouldn't just be some random DNA profile. It would be a direct link to the crime. And that could have easily changed how the court saw things, maybe even leading to a totally different result.
Wow.
It just shows how even seemingly small details can have a massive impact in these cases.
Like a lethal butterfly effect.
It is. One tiny change in the evidence or how it's presented, and the whole outcome can shift.
Exactly. And that's why it's so important to analyze and discuss cases like Williams.
I agree.
They force us to really think about the complexities of forensic evidence and how it impacts our whole legal system.
You're absolutely right.
Welcome back to The Deep Dive. We've been exploring Williams v. Illinois, a case that's really shown us how forensic science, new technology, and the Sixth Amendment all intersect. Before the break, you were talking about some potential long-term consequences of this case. What do you think might happen from here?
Well, one thing we might see is more reliance on third-party labs for forensic analysis.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, if prosecutors are worried about confrontation clause issues, using a separate lab could be a way to, you know, put some distance between themselves and the creation of those reports. It might lower the risk of key evidence being excluded.
So they're basically creating a legal buffer zone between themselves and the evidence.
Exactly. But this could lead to problems with accountability and transparency.
How so?
Well, if more and more forensic work is being done in these private labs, how can we be sure they're using good scientific practices? And how can we make sure defendants can still challenge the evidence?
Yeah, those are important questions. What about the cost of all this? Could this create a situation where wealthier defendants have an advantage because they can afford their own testing and experts while others are left behind?
That's a big worry. We don't want a system where the quality of your defense depends on how much money you have. Everyone should have the resources they need to defend themselves, regardless of their financial situation.
I agree. It seems like Williams v. Illinois, even though it was about a specific case, has brought up all these bigger questions about the future of forensic evidence in our legal system.
It really has. It's a case that's far from settled. Its impact will continue as technology keeps advancing, and the courts try to adapt and understand these complex issues. We're in uncharted territory, both scientifically and legally.
So much to consider. We've covered a lot today, but I want to leave our listeners with a final thought. Imagine you could just create a whole new legal framework for dealing with forensic evidence.
Okay.
What would it look like? What would be the most important principles?
That's a great question. For me, it comes down to finding the right balance. We need reliable scientific evidence, but we also need to protect the fundamental rights of the accused. We need clear rules about when a lab report is considered testimonial. We need solid procedures so the defense can challenge scientific findings. And most importantly, everyone needs access to good legal representation, no matter how much money they have.
That's well said. We can't lose sight of those core principles of fairness and due process as we strive for efficiency and embrace new scientific tools.
I couldn't agree more. It's about finding that balance where science and justice work together.
This has been a really insightful look at a case that might seem simple on the surface. But as we've discovered, Williams v. Illinois is anything but simple. It reveals some of the challenges our legal system faces as it tries to keep up with the constantly changing world of forensic science.
It's definitely given our listeners a lot to think about.
And that's exactly what we aim for here at The Deep Dive. We want to give you the knowledge and tools to engage with these complex issues and form your own informed opinions. So, until next time, keep those legal minds sharp, and remember, the pursuit of justice requires us to constantly question, think critically, and be willing to adapt to the world around us. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive.
It was my pleasure.